Welcome to If You've Come This Far. This is the podcast that Sean and I do where we get to have great conversations with people who are trying to leave the world better than they found it. This episode is with Gary Barker, who co-founded a nonprofit called Equimundo. It's an organization that's dedicated to promoting social justice and gender equality by engaging men and boys in that kind of work and educating them in that through that lens, which should sound familiar to anyone who's listened to our podcast or been involved with Men Living. So I think, Sean, you first came across Gary. You want to tell us more about him?
Yeah, I mean, I've known about Equimundo for a long time, and Gary's work there. I think it's amazing the reach that they have and the work that they do worldwide, trying to touch every kind of corner of the globe in working with boys and men. Smart, emotional, heartfelt. I mean, he talked about the relationship with his dad and the fact that at some level he's carrying on his dad's work. Mm-hmm. I found that to be, you know, particularly touching. And again, he's one of those guys you think about, okay, I mean, he's nonstop. And the interesting thing is he talks about being on sabbatical recently, right? And how he was, you know, trying to be disengaged, appropriately so that he could recharge to do the work that he does. And just from a Men Living perspective, I mean, it's an organization that, you know, we gain inspiration from, certainly.
Yeah. I mean, this is I think that describes the difference between someone who has a job and someone who has a vocation. Mm-hmm. I don't think I led us down that path, but I always love hearing people's stories. Like, where did you grow up? Who raised you? How did you get here? And yeah, he's got a great story.
He does. I think people really like it. I also just want to make one other point. Another thing that has stuck with me is he talks about allies, and there's a lot of conversation about, mm-hmm. you know, men and women and marginalized groups and the whole concept of allies. And I think he has a very interesting perspective on that. One that's stayed with me and I try to communicate as I go forward as well.
When you get someone in the conversation who can make sense of it as a good communicator, but also a level head, I think it's huge.
Well, he did. It's funny. He did. What really made me reach out to him is he's recently done, maybe not recently, it might've been end of last year, a TED talk at a woman's conference, and the audience was primarily female. And, you know, he makes some jokes. Okay, I'm not mansplaining. That's not what I'm trying to do, but he took, I think, some brave stances. In fact, that he was in front of that audience to explain some of his positions, and I think, I applaud him for that. The women applauded him for that, and I think it's important. I mean, he's not shying away from difficult subject.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, brave. Brave is not a bad adjective to describe Gary
Barker. We talk about brave in the conversation, not only as it relates to that session, but as it relates to going and doing this work in the world, for sure. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well, let's do it then. Here's Gary Barker.
Let's listen to Gary. Yeah. Hey, Gary.
How's it going?
Nice to meet you.
Likewise.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
So the first thing we have to start is, so Chris lives in the city of Chicago, and I'm in Glen Ellen, which is about 26 miles west. And you've had a couple stints here.
Yes.
How was your time in Chicago? Did you enjoy it?
Well, you know, my daughter was born there, and I did my PhD there. So that's like two children born there, one born than the other. So, so absolutely. We had moved from Brazil, from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. So there was a bit of a, you know, thermal shock.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
It seemed like a good place to, you know, get pregnant, have a child. No, we did love it. If the weather was like a little bit different. I do think it's one of the world's most beautiful cities.
It's a great, but I would say Chris can vouch because I wasn't here the whole time, but I think there was more days in the 60s than there were in the 30s in February.
Okay.
Is that true, Chris?
I'm guessing that's true. And I'm not sure that that's something we should be totally on board with, right?
I was going to say, right. Yeah. That's
right.
Yeah, I worry about that sometimes. Now, I'm going to push back, Gary. I have to confirm. Are you in D.C. now?
I am in D.C., yeah. I've been away for about a month, but this is home, yeah.
Okay, so this is... I lived in D.C. for a stint. My wife is and was a political junkie, so she lived here in the D.C. in the 90s.
Okay.
And I'm always miffed by the D.C. folks who are like, oh, Chicago. It's kind of like Chicago folks saying, oh, Minneapolis is too cold. Because, you know, on January 13th, you're not going outside in either of those cities. So I don't know if D.C. is exactly balmy compared to Chicago. Anyway, I love D.C.
It's how long winter lasts. Yeah, you know, yeah, January and February, well.
Fair point. You
know, when we manage our lives well, we get to spend at least part of January in Brazil, which is the middle of summer there. So that's nice. Kind of, that's a hack that we do to survive.
Wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed.
I got it.
Yeah.
I got to say, Chris, I think we're following an old guy pattern where we're starting to open more and more of our podcast talking about the weather, which, we need correct course on that. So let me do that. Let me correct course. So Gary, Equimundo is a worldwide organization. You said, you've been gone for a month. So where have you been recently?
Part of that was in the UK. We're doing a lot of work with school systems in the UK on building a healthy masculinities curriculum into their, they have essentially a social emotional learning hour a week that's mandated in the school curriculum. We've been working with them on building in a conversation about healthy masculinity and gender. Mm-hmm. As part of that. And then 2 weeks away for my own self-care. We give staff after 5 years or 10 years at the organization a sabbatical break, and I was on part of mine with my daughter. So I was in the Western National Parks, Yosemite, Zion, Bryce Canyon, Mesa Verde, Rocky Mountains, and just hiking, nice. Hanging, staying offline. And then I was at the beginning of this week. I just came back. What is today? Today's Friday. I just came back yesterday from New York. The Commission on the Status of Women, which is the biggest UN annual event on gender equality, was there. And we had probably, it's still going on and we still have staff there. We've probably had about 10 sessions there on what's up with men and boys and how do we bring men and boys into this conversation at a moment when there's a lot of pushback on the kind of obvious, need for men and boys to be part of that solution.
So before we go into that deeply, I want to applaud you for modeling the sabbatical, because there's plenty of leaders of organizations who would say, hey, this is what we do. This is a benefit of living, and wouldn't do it. So I don't know if that's hard for you to do or it's pretty easy, but I just want to applaud the fact that you model what you want your organization to be.
It's hard. I mean, it did take, takes a village kind of thing. I had to work with staff on help me do this well. And I applaud them for kind of like Gary, staff line.
How did you do?
I had two work calls over 2 weeks, which that's pretty amazing.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, I mean, for as the CEO and, stuff going on in so many time zones, there's HR issues. There's, a funder who wants to talk. They want to talk to you, Gary. There's a journalist who wants to say something. So yeah, my staff was really good and I managed to just be on two calls. It helped, of course, to be in places where Wi-Fi connection was often non-existent.
Right. Yes. That's the genius of your plan right there.
Exactly.
How old is your daughter, Gary?
She's 26.
And did she help sort of nudge you to make this happen?
Well, she was working part of that time remotely, and she had to work at probably 3 days out of that time. And when she was working, she's like, "Dad, just because I'm working, you should not be. Stay off."
Oh, good for her.
Here's what you can So yeah, I suppose if anything, she is modeling, you know, that the job that, yeah, just the work ethic or obsession or workaholic patterns we have in our household.
So let's get into it. So the place where I'd like to start is, there's so many places we could go with the work that you're doing. But what really struck me is, so your TED Women's Talk in October, that you did, was just, I mean, you got a standing O at the end, but for me, there was a couple, there was some energy that I want to talk about. So as you were going through and explaining this and please share more with the audience, you know, you made some jokes about, okay, I hope I'm not mansplaining to you, and the ladies were clapping and laughing at a lot of what you had to say. And then when you started talking about the issues around violence and men and how we're conditioned and the idea of caring for men, there seemed to be less applause. And the ladies in the audience struggled with that for me what I heard. And yeah. So I've wanted to ask you, did I hear that right? In the end, there was still a standing O for what you had to say. But did I hear that right? I mean, it's a difficult topic, and I just would love for you to talk about this idea of caring for men, if you would.
Yeah, I, you know, Sean, it is a great observation. And it did feel a little bit like it kind of took some warming up for women. For the women in the room, it was a 90% women audience, mm-hmm. to kind of come into the space and go, we hear him. Let us think about this. And then it felt like the looks that were coming from the audience were, oh yeah, we have to. You know, I think, I mean, we've got to acknowledge there's a lot of women who feel like men owe them something. Men owe them the place at the table, the job, the fair wage, a partner who's, you know, not doing as many of the hours of the care work as she would want him to do. You know, I mean, stuck behind our emotional shields, right? And so yeah. He owes me more emotional expression. And so, you know, I think my argument is kind of saying, you're going to have to, this is not like we snap our fingers and men are all going to be, you know, the perfect partners. And in fact, you're going to have to listen because we probably have some things to say as well. It's not all on us. and so that's a longer, I think once they heard all those pieces through, I did feel an overwhelming, yeah, okay, you're right. But it was more that one step back of, wait, mm-hmm. you know, is he asking us to do one more care thing for men? Like, right. Are we not doing enough for men already? And afterwards, the conversations in the hallways were, you know, I wasn't sure where it was going to go, but you convinced me, yes, we have got to, you know, be about caring deeply for men, and that's how we're going to get men to care. I think that's probably that happens at a TED event. You know, I've just been on the Commission of the Status of Women, right, that I mentioned. Right. This is about 4,000 delegates from around the world, not-for-profit organizations, activists on women's rights. And, you know, in the TED talk, I could get women on board with me in 13 minutes. I don't mean to say I have any magic superpower, but just thinking really like how to make that argument. At the Commission on the Status of Women with activists, it feels like it's been a 10-year convincing of men should be allies here. And we're much more complex than, you know, then yes, there are men using violence against women. We have to keep talking about that. But there, you know, if we step into this conversation with care and compassion, men are, you know, will join us. I'll just add that there was one session that I loved. I was just about like, I was almost in tears at the beginning of it because of the Czech government and the Mexican government organized it. And they called it Boys Don't Cry. And they had that song playing when we came in. And it was essentially about that, how care for boys helps us end men's violence against women. And I thought, it was like, right. Can I hug you guys now? Right. Yeah. You got, right, this is it. The arc of ending violence against women requires looking at the emotional lives of boys and men. But that was like 10 years ago. They would not have felt brave enough. They probably wouldn't have had that argument. So Sean, all to say, you were right in that perception. And it's a long, patient talk.
Yeah. Do you find, Gary, in that example, do you find that, are you working with the Czech and Mexican governments in implementing programs that actually are supporting, you know, their position on this?
We're working with the Mexican government, the boyhood work that I mentioned in the UK, we're implementing in public schools in Mexico, and working with NGOs and state governments there. And the head of the National Institute of Women, so we don't have an equivalent in the US, but essentially the national government body responsible for women's equality, the head of that work has been an ally, the head of that agency, sorry, has been an ally for engaging men and boys for years. Yeah. So that's where it really matters. The Czech government has been working with probably the oldest, one of the first ever programs working with male perpetrators in Norway, called Alternatives to Violence. And they've been doing a lot of exchange with the Czech government for years. And the Alternatives to Violence model, I remember I visited back in like the late 90s when we were doing some training in Brazil of setting up some of the first perpetrator battery intervention programs in Brazil. And I asked them, because the question was always, how many sessions do you do? And the Norwegian said, well, we do them as long as the man needs it to stop using violence.
Oh, wow.
And I just had this like, holy whatever, right? Because we get funds in the US and in Brazil to kind of do 16 sessions or maybe.
Yeah, right, right.
But they said, well, how do you do that? You can't do that, right? The support to help a man overcome a journey of violence might be years. It might be 10. That compassion was coming in the room at this session earlier this week.
Well, I use this analogy about what we're trying to do is, so, okay, if I want to be good at golf, I view that I have to go hit golf balls. I need to practice. I can't just go out on the course and shoot 84 like Chris can.
Right.
I have to actually work at my game. And so I just look at it. Okay, if you want to be a better human, a better man, you need to practice. You need to get into spaces where you can have these conversations to be vulnerable and explore and be curious. A workshop's a great stat, but it can't be the end, right?
Yeah.
Or your game begins to suffer.
Yeah.
Well, Gary, I would love if we could sort of disaggregate this work with boys and this work with men a little bit more. I work in the education space. I would argue that sort of the most effective lever to sort of reversing racism and gender inequality and a lot of the other ills that ail us, that the ROI working with kids is greater than working with adults. And I don't want to forsake the male perpetrators of any of those things.
Yeah.
But I just wonder, as someone who runs a nonprofit and has to make investment decisions, you know, do you keep track of that? And if you had a choice, would you say like, okay, well, look, the bang for my buck and the benefit to the world and the impact that I'm going to generate is going to be better if I work with boys? I don't know. Like, is that something that you guys ever talk about?
Yeah. And, you know, but, and I think I agree with most of that, you know, working at younger ages makes a bigger difference. And just pragmatically, it's kind of easier to get boys and young men to come to these conversations than it is to get adult men often. Mm. So, you know, there's both the energy required to sort of make it happen. And I suppose our conversation has been as well. So, you know, when I started our predecessor organization in Brazil, and that's now 3-4 years ago, we've been doing group education with young and adult men since then.
Uh-huh.
And there's probably, you know, how many, the number of countries we can name that have basically taken this on and kept doing it is probably 3 or 4, right? It's just a huge, you know, you get new staff, they lose interest, they made it part of the school curriculum, they took it out because there was a political shift or,
sure.
It's, you know, the things that have stuck are the work on boys, so younger age, and the stuff with fathers. Because, you know, and I think both moments we've got with, and I absolutely agree with you, Chris, and I know, you know, your work is in the school sector. If we can get it in the school, it's got a kind of self-fulfilling loop that teachers, you know, school principals will go, oh man, I can see the difference. I want this to stay, right? So it's got a longer, it's got longer staying power. And then with dads, you know, whether you're kind of coming to fatherhood like prime that you should be, you know, the hands-on caregiver as equal as your female partner, if you're in a heterosexual relationship, you know, or you're in that like, oh hell, what do I do now? Right. The deer in the headlights moment. If you've had a previous relationship and you're estranged from that child, you know, there's lots of reasons why I think dads come to this conversation saying, please, I need some information. I want to work on this. So those are the two places that I would say, you know, of 20X years of throwing the spaghetti at the wall, the stick are, yeah, you know, boys and fathers really seem to, young men, yes. And that's where we started, kind of the 13 to 20-ish age range. That's harder to get to stick in youth programming and secondary schools. I think there's a huge amount to do there. We're now looking online, right? As we look at how much of young men's lives are happening there, connecting with Movember and some others. So yeah, Chris, I'm in agreement with that, with your affirmation.
I'm gonna thank you for that. And I want to take add a follow on there. My guess is that the curriculum that works in Brazil may not be the curriculum that works in the UK, which may not be the curriculum that works with boys in the Czech Republic, right? Is that like, how does it differ as you go around the world?
I mean, the what's a good way to describe this? Like the format or the, our parlor tricks, let me put it that way. Our parlor tricks are the same. The content differs. So, you know, what we do to get young men, adult men, boys to kind of put down the, you know, the emotional armor, be vulnerable, that usually kind of similar sorts of stuff we'll do, right? The same kind of role play stuff, same kind of moving around, the same kind of reflection on what happens at home, some similar homework activities. The content will shift based a lot on context. But there are, you know, I would say that there are, we do after these years, like our first version from Latin America probably had like 80 plus group education activities. And then we worked with teachers, facilitators to like choose the best, you know, 10 to 20 that work for you. You know, we have over the years, I think, figured out kind of, you know, five or six that are kind of like all of our trainers will sort of have those in their starter kit. So, you know, I mean, I think it is ultimately about trying to create a safe space where something, it's never this question, but it's something like, how's that manhood going for you? That's never the literal question, but essentially it's trying to get a first conversation about that. And then the arc becomes, and how does this play out for people around you? So that we kind of, you put your own mask on and then we're moving you to put on, you know, to look at the person next to you. How do girls experience this in your school? How do you think mom's dealing with the fact that dad's not around and he's kind of, you know, and not always, that's a stereotype and it's also largely true. And then it arcs toward, you know, let's work on some very specific things you can do better, differently, how you communicate emotions in a more honest but not hurtful way. How, you know, we may include consent will be a deeper one for the 15-year-olds. For the younger boys, it might be around bullying. Like, what do you do when you see bullying if that is a, you know, an issue there? So the arc, you know, is kind of that. Put on your own mask. Look at those next to you. What can you do? That arc seems to work pretty well if we can. I mean, it all depends on the facilitator. If you ask me, you know, the other question, does a curriculum matter? I would say, well, actually the facilitator matters.
Yeah.
A good facilitator can sort of do this with, you know, with whatever curriculum is in front of them is kind of my
no doubt
simple pat answer to that one. Yeah.
So then that makes me think about parents. So, I mean, you talk about working with dads, moms are obviously a very important part in that. And we recently interviewed a friend of ours, Dr. John Duffy, who wrote a book called Rescuing Our Sons. And it was really kind of his interaction with both his boys and young men and his girls and young women in his practice. And there's a piece in there where he talks about sitting with the mom and son and the mom saying, you know, it's not your time, it's your sister's. And he's a boy of like 15. So basically saying, no, this is, I mean, men have had their time and now yours has passed. And here's this 15-year-old boy saying, okay, well, what am I supposed to do? Who am I supposed to be?
Yeah.
And so I'm curious if you hear any of that as you go, you know, around the world, both in men's spaces and women's spaces. And in terms of allyship, how can I be an ally if I don't know who I am?
Yeah.
Is part of what I struggle with around that whole concept. So reaction to that?
Yeah. I mean, thinking about that consultation, you know, that consultation room, I was thinking about a dinner that I had with, let me just put their high diplomatic officials who represent their governments who were in New York this last week. And we were talking with them about, you know, why are young men pushing back on gender equality, et cetera. And one of them said, and I won't mention any more details to give away who she was, said, well, you know, when men talk about how they have it difficult now with mental health and job insecurity and kind of confusion of who they are, I just want to look back and say, you've been on top for 6,000 years, like just get with it. And, you know, I looked and I sort of laughed and went, yeah, politically, historically, over the arc of human history, you're absolutely right. And that does me absolutely no good with a 15-year-old boy or an adult man.
Right.
His reality and the fact that we answer that, and she was referring to kind of a man who was running into the kind of the edge of his career in the diplomatic corps in his country, because there is a big push for affirmative action.
Yeah, sure.
And as there needs to be, because it's
absolutely
about, diplomatic corps globally are about 80% women. It's shifting. Sorry, 80% men. It's shifting a bit, but it's still, you know, a few countries have advanced. So you get, okay, we need this as a policy, but he's still a human being who's trying to figure out, you know,
right,
what's the rest of his career. Partly you want to say, you know, I would say if part of the rest of your life feels interesting, your caregiving activities, what you're doing on, you know, is there something else that's giving him meaning in life? So he doesn't feel like, oh, this is my everything. And you're pulling this, you're kind of giving me the chance to, you know, I aspired all my life to be ambassador level or whatever. Like, let's not ignore by just thinking we can tell the son, right? Hey, it's your sister's time on the planet because you've been in charge forever. Because that 15-year-old boy is in his right to say, well, not really me.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not the Elon Musk. I'm not King Charles. Right. I mean,
yeah.
Or whoever. So I'm using, you know, some Stratman specifically there. Right. But
I've kind my wife sometimes says, oh, men living, what, that's the Boohoo Men program. I'm like, okay. Right. That's not what we're trying to do, but I think the person that you were sitting with would probably be like, oh yeah, I'm with her. Boohoo man.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess what, you know, sometimes what I'll come back with my first database one will be when we do badly, women pick up the pieces.
That's right.
Right.
And you do enough picking up of the pieces as women already. we as men want to do our part to, you know, kind of also do self-care. And, you know, that's one of our studies was Care Leads to Care, which is, you know, we need the Boohoo Men group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My wife called it the Water Buffaloes group. Some of the first groups that I did. Right. Uh-huh. And it has taken a while to go, oh yeah, you know, men actually doing some self-care become better for all of us. So I think it's like,
right.
I live with that joke. I wasn't defensive when I heard this senior diplomatic official say this, but I just sort of gently, you know, kind of said, well, what does that do for him in the short term? And what happens if, you know, maybe in an extreme incident of it, we see the anger, we see violence, we see the frustration that comes out and happens to all of us. Like, what do we do? I agree with you politically, but the short term, we all live now, right? We're here.
Right.
And he's frustrated about this. What, like, we, at the very least, a conversation.
Right.
An acknowledgement that this is tough for you. And not just to assume that affirmative action, we checked it off, we're all progressive, we believe in it. And right. Every man affected by that is like, okay. So I don't think we're, anyway. Yeah. That's a real question today.
Hey, listeners. If you enjoy our show, please consider following us or sharing the show with a friend. And I want to take a quick second to shout out our sponsor, Half Acre Beer Company, from their iconic Daisy Cutter Pale Ale to the refreshing Bodum IPA. All of the beers that these guys are making are a testament to quality and to their passion for brewing. So cheers to Half Acre Beer Company for supporting if you've come this far and for brewing great beers. And now let's get back to the show. Can I sneak in a quick business question, Gary?
Yeah, is that sure, okay, Sean? Of course.
Again, as someone who works in the nonprofit field, it looks to me, I peaked at your 990. It looks to me you certainly have some program service revenue, but you also raise a lot of money from philanthropy, it looks like.
Yep.
How has that market looked for you recently? Is it getting easier to sell this idea of, look, there's real impact to be made if you can write us a check and we can put this money to use in K-12 schools, yada, yada. Like, how's that going for you all?
It's been reasonably stable. I don't feel that it's like massively growing, but I think we've been fortunate to find some brave foundations that often either came out of the violence prevention field or the gender equality field and it's almost always a few brave program officers who will basically say, we need this work with men and boys too. There are some other, program officers who feel like, oh, wait, these funds were set aside for women and girls in violence prevention. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to focus on women and girls. Mm-hmm. I think our conversation has been to say much of the work, that school-based work that I mentioned, it is with boys and girls. We're circling boys because it is about talking about manhood. And the benefits are multiple for boys themselves, for girls. And when teachers and principals love it, and parents as well, then we start to see the ripple of everybody seeing what happens if you get a healthy manhood going on at that place. Uh-huh. I think our kind of favorable niche of, if you looked at several years of our 990s, it's been, it depends on when you count revenue in a year when it comes in, but we've been pretty stable, not massive growth, because we're not trying to take, we are aware there's a lot of groups vying for funds. We don't think success for us is becoming, having five times the size of our budget. For us, it's having five times the number of organizations who do this work. Yes. And, we're inspired by some of our ideas. A key part to us in that whole, getting Gates on board, getting Oak Foundation and others is the evidence base that we've been spending a lot of time doing, randomized control evaluation studies and the like that have all their limitations, of course. But it's been important for a lot of donors who are driven by, does the evidence hold up, that we've spent some years doing that. Yeah.
Those names are all very familiar to me. And I know that evidence-based is certainly, it's been a growing, and reasonably so. Like, I came from the private sector. Like, I want to, before I write you a check, I want to see the data. Mm-hmm. But the other keyword, tricky phrase, also reasonable, in my opinion, is scale. And I'm curious if you're getting the push to take advantage of technology to scale some of your programming, rather than having that one excellent facilitator in that classroom in Rio with 12 young boys.
Yeah. Absolutely. And even before, so we've done some testing of our, the group education model online with school sectors in a couple of countries. Have not had a funding opportunity yet to do sort of a 2-year follow-up the way that we've done with our face-to-face work. But we have in the US and in Peru, we have tested approaches online. There's one that's still ongoing, funded by NIH, that's happening in Pittsburgh with a more trauma-informed model. So we'll be able to kind of say in a year or so, how's that going? Our gut feeling is that the face-to-face is more impactful. There is a relationship that, you can build, et cetera, but there's other ways. We're also testing in Colombia a model with fathers where it's been really tough to get kind of consistent fathers groups, because these are low-income dads who are working fill in the blank 10-hour days. you know, and 2 hours of commute wherever they're headed. Mm-hmm. Some of those are also Venezuelan refugee dads. So, you know, to kind of where they have to find a moment where you get all those dads together is really tough. So we're using WhatsApp. WhatsApp is a way to, you know, and it may actually be very little group education, like one, you know, barbecue on a Saturday, bring your kids, we play a game, et cetera. And then the rest are, we connect with you over WhatsApp and we refer you to services if issues come up. We also have not raised funds yet for a full randomized control trial of that. So yeah, we're testing. And then one of our most recent ones that we're right in the heart of it now is kind of looking at this crisis of connection of young men in the U.S. We did a study we launched last year, State of American Men, showing just, you know, youngest guys are just suffering tremendously. A third don't see anybody outside their house on a weekly basis. About half think of suicide, half thought of suicide in the past 2 weeks. Two-thirds say nobody really knows me. A third can't find a relationship and don't really believe intimate partner relationship and kind of don't believe they ever will. And they're spending and about half say their online lives are more interesting than their offline lives.
Ugh.
Yeah. So, you know, that's heavy stuff to, I realized that was a lot of, you know, like heavy stats all at once. Based on that, we're working with a group that's spent a lot of time looking at online interventions. And we're engaging them to like map, how do we engage young men in the vast, vast positive stuff that's happening online, right? It's really easy to look at, you know, the so-called manosphere, and even we don't like that word. But, you know, probably they've done the mapping of numerically of kind of where young men are online, 75% is either positive or innocuous. Mm-hmm. And the 20-25% that's what we might call the manosphere, the Andrew Tate stuff and much, much more, is a minority of where young men are online. And so, but in that positive stuff, what you find is a huge amount of guys just asking for help. And just looking to connect with other guys. So we are trying to build that out. That space to us feels like it needs just a lot more. Movember is trying some work on this as well. They've engaged, they're trying to test whether can you engage positive influencers and support them to build their, you know, to build their followers. That seems really tough to do, I think, is the first conclusion, because like we're not really good at saying who's gonna be the next. You know, the next influencer is going to take off. It's like, could you spot a Taylor Swift, you know, at a kindergarten and know who it's going to be? It's like, anyway.
Are you familiar with with Diverting Hate program? Yeah. So we're partners with Caitlin and Diverting Hate in their program. We'll be interviewing her soon. They're trying to address, I think it's a very innovative approach to this.
Yeah.
Which we'll talk about with our listeners soon. The thing that I want to explore with you is I want to talk about the word you use. You talked about brave funders or brave leaders of foundations. I think that word's very interesting because it occurred to me, and I'm going to talk about the State of Man report at the end. It says, for their sake and all of ours, we must redefine bravery as the willingness to go into our uncertain future with courage, knowing that it'll be better all around for each and every individual, for the world, and for our loved ones. Bravery is it seems like it's a big word for you. How does it play in this work that you're doing?
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's, you know, from those of us who work on, you know, with men and boys directly on manhood, right? The bravery to, you know, to strip off the armor that we inherited from, you know, dads, fathers, other men around us, that we have to be these emotionally stoic, you know, go it alone, don't ask for help, pretend we know it all the time. So one, there's individual bravery of just men and boys. And I think, you know, it just... I guess it's become the word that I found that kind of works the best in a moment where we keep talking about toxic masculinity.
Yeah,
like that's just not, it's so obviously not a conversation starter, but I'm still amazed by how many individuals women in many parts, but not only, who don't get why, you know, we're kind of our own worst enemies as progressives, which kind of not getting, why is it that most men, when you use that expression, just like turn off and don't want to talk to you about anything else? Mm-hmm. Whereas bravery seems to be a quality that like my daughter can get behind, mm-hmm. and a 5-year-old boy can get behind, and some adult men can get behind, and then say, so what do we define that as? Not just that I, you know, continue to play through whatever sport it is when my knee is about to fall off, but about how do I push back when I know this is causing harm? Everybody else around, or many people around, are kind of going along with it. Am I brave enough to stand up to it? And we've often defined that harm as, you know, some enemy at the gate. But what if the enemy is actually the way we've learned manhood?
Right.
And am I brave enough to stand up to that? And I think for women, female identified individuals in our space of gender equality, it has been, you know, the default and the need in the field for years has been, I have to stand up for women who are, you know, 16%, you know, getting 16% less pay on a daily basis, are the victims of men's violence, are picking up all the care duties that men aren't doing. I've got to stand up for women. And that's true. And yet it doesn't go upstream and change the problem. And so it's been really brave women in this space who say, we need men on this.
Yeah.
Not as a men versus women thing, but we're all in this together, breaking waves of cycles of violence, you know, really achieving full equality. You can't just presume men are objects to be, you know, hey, sit there and take it. Affirmative action is going to do this and you don't exist and don't have a voice. I think brave women have acknowledged it's more complicated than that. And so it does feel like a, you know, a word that we need it at multiple levels. Funders who may have, that their funds are based on kind of identity politics. So even, let's say, in racial justice. So some brave funders who work in racial justice who say, I need to support people of color-led organizations, and I need some white folks in the room as well.
Right.
And I need white folks talking to white folks to be in the room as well. That it's so, you know, the kind of way, the way we market the not-for-profit sector, it means it does take bravery for program officers to kind of get, it's more complicated than, you know, racial justice means I got to work with white folks who are perpetuating the harm.
Right.
So yeah, that's kind of my multiple levels of bravery.
Yeah. We had a guest, Kareth Foster, whose sort of mission is to engage white people in anti-racist conversations, because the thing is, like, it's, yeah, affirmative action can be helpful, but everything moves more quickly when we engage all the stakeholders, especially those who have been at the top for the last 6,000 years, to your point.
Yeah.
You've said this, I think Richard Reeves said it in his book. It's like, we could do two things at once. And so at some point it feels a little bit brave to say, yeah, I'm an ally, but that doesn't mean that I'm not coming to the table to have a conversation about how we both win. And yeah, I'll acknowledge that, you know, we've had whatever control for 6,000 years, but it's today. Yeah. And I know that might be, and that's what I thought I saw in the audience during your talk, was struggling with today versus the past.
Yeah. Yeah. Where do we move in with that one? I was just going to even step back to the word ally, which is, you know, occasionally in that looking back to 6,000 years and say, well, allyship, you know, let's look at NATO, right? NATO works that, okay, you attack Poland and we have to go defend them. And also, if somebody attacks the US, Poland has to come defend us. So, you know, and then watch the silence in the room of going, oh, I mean, that's what allyship means.
Right. That's right? Totally.
So,
right.
A 4-year-old boy of, you know, experiencing violence, you know, don't bullying from another guy, don't we also want to be an ally at his side? Mm-hmm. And what about the 15-year-old boy who's struggling with, like, how to define consent and his ideas about that? Doesn't he also need some allyship on, you know, kind of, don't we also need to come to his side in understanding, you know, where he's from? And so that that notion that allyship is bi-directional, I think is still a tough one for us. And, you know, I think, like, you know, a lot of our data is affirms what we already knew, but we needed it in big numbers to be able to make the case. And so if, you know, if I'm at, you know, the Commission on the Status of Women, and I say, look, the childhoods of boys are where the harm to women starts. Mm-hmm. You know, it is those who witness it, experience violence growing up, that are 2 to 3 times more likely to use it later on. You've got to care about those boys. And it's not a, it's, you've made this artificial equation that it's only, you know, we of course have to look first at what's happened to the survivor of this violence and how we support her and create systems that hold any man accountable for the use of violence. But if you care about prevention and if you want to stop it from happening in the first place, I heard a colleague who referred to it, I need an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, but I also need some health educators at the top of the cliff. And it's not, we can't, I really push back when I hear somebody say it's either or. It's just, yeah. And that Richard's comment on, you know, you can't only do one of those things. It's like, it's an obscene choice.
Right.
Could I only help the survivor and not think about what could I do if I know some things work to keep the violence from happening? Are you going to tell me I don't have enough resources to do both? It just,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we've made so much progress as humanity. Let's engage everyone to get us over the hump. I mean, to get us to the end game.
Yeah.
There's tons of work to do, but let's get everybody together to get us to the end game.
Gary, I always need to, I'm always curious about people's story. And you seem to me to be somebody who is very much engaged in not just a career, like, but a vocation. I'm wondering if maybe you'll say, oh, I just happened to end up here. But I'm curious about your childhood, your family, your upbringing. Is there something about that that led you to the work that you're doing now?
Yeah, absolutely. This was not like a, you know, when there's that vocational discussion when you're 13 years old, you know, where's the of the list of things, you know, on those vocational aptitude tests, it was nothing about being an ally for gender equality and healthy masculinities.
No.
and as a 13, you know, I think that wouldn't have been just like a rational career choice. Yeah, let me go to that. It is very much about what I, you know, what I saw growing up. My father was a social worker his whole career. He was a scholarship football player, University of Idaho, got injured and, you know, full football body, became a social worker when I was, you know, that now. And I was born when he was doing his first placement, working with migrant farm workers in the Central Valley in California. And so, you know, my two siblings are adopted. My dad's, you know, conversations at the dinner table were about children who needed out-of-home care. And almost always it was about men's violence, mm-hmm. Economic, social, physical. And, you know, those were part of our dinner table conversations of what my dad's work was. And my mom is an amazing support to that. And so, you know, on the one hand, it was kind of, you know, I had the blessing of a father who was, who made care his vocation. Now he, you know, my mom did a lot more of the vast majority of the hands-on care of us. But his political, you know, for him, care was a political thing, right? It was, how do we make systems protect children? And that was a mostly female profession.
Yeah.
And he talked about that as well, if, you know, without using all the gendered language we use now, but kind of his awareness of, you know, I was this scholarship football player from a farming family, and I went on to do a profession that was mostly considered female. So I, you know, the blessing of that, he passed away, you know, 2.5 years ago. Mm. And then at the same time we moved to Texas when I was 9, 10, bullying, guys with guns, including a guy with a gun, and I talk about this in the TED Talk, who killed another witness to school shooting. And it's about boys and men. It is about boys and men with guns. It's about hurting boys and men. It's about boys and men who hurt, who also have guns. And, you know, at first that was just like, get me the hell out of this place and let me go somewhere else. But it was over years of just making sense of what was it about? What were the drivers of that? And why did I feel this like this visceral fear at certain kinds of boys and men in my high school and around that, and really wanted to be out of that setting. and then to make sense and say, oh no, I have to work on this. I can't run from this. There's no running away from men's violence. It doesn't just happen in my suburban Houston high school. It's everywhere. And it was easier for me. We also have family ties in Latin America. And I learned Spanish growing up. One of those adopted children from Guatemala had a reason to learn Spanish. One of my dad's uncles married a woman from Mexico, and they were often with us. We were often with them. So I had a reason to learn Spanish early on. And in many ways, it was easier for me to work on men and violence, like not in my culture. I can find a way to be compassionate toward you instead of just being angry and afraid. Mm-hmm. And if anything, and now my career, you know, coming back to the US is like, I got to work on it here. Because it's tough stuff. I think the other part, you know, Chris, and I always, you know, would love to hear from the two of you. This is emotionally draining work that we do. Well, and maybe my question to the two of you is, you know, kind of how do you take care of that part? This is not easy stuff to, you know, we're not just doing a kind of feel good PR campaign.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I don't want this to be about Sean and me because I worry about our listenership declining. But
they would be gone by now if we didn't have people like Gary coming to talk. Yeah,
I will say this though, Gary, about that question is the first third of my career. Well, that's actually the math is changing the older I get. But I spent the 90s as a submarine officer in the Navy. I spent the aughts after my MBA in private sector finance, and then re-career around Obama One to nonprofit education. And what I found was that while it is draining, working to serve is also what fills my cup, right? If I 8 or 10 years in the aughts where I was working in private sector finance, trying to help people get richer, if people asked me what I did for a living or what my job was, I wanted to talk about that for about 6 seconds and then change the subject as fast as possible. Want to talk to me about submarines or about what we're doing to improve education for Black, Brown, and poor kids? You know, amen. Let's go. Let's grab a couple cocktails. So there's a push and a pull. And Sean, I'll shut up and I would love to hear your take.
No, I would piggyback on that a little bit and just say I think there's two things that you know, self-care is self-care, but what keeps me going, and I'm sure you see this too, Gary, is one is research organizations like yours, and you're implementing as well, but you research and reading books like Richard's is like, okay, here are these ideas and concepts. It's like, those are brilliant. I want to go implement them. Mm. And so there's a fire that gets built around the data and proposed solutions and say, okay, can we build a platform to do that? And then the second thing is the people that you engage with, that the benefit from the things that we're doing is like, okay, this is what it's all about. And, you know, and then if one more person goes forward and carries forward what they experienced, then it begins to build a fire. It's actually kind of easy. I mean, there are days when, I mean, I'm sure when you're traveling the world, you're like, holy shit, am I tired? then you get some rest and you go again.
Yeah. And I agree with you, Sean, on the kind of, the energy from other folks who are, you know, trying this, believe in it, support it. You know, the moms in the audience at the TED Talk and who wanted to talk afterwards, the couple of them who was like, I want my son to talk to you.
Yeah.
You know, the one who's interested in doing, you know, doing an internship and like, how do you make a career out of this work on healthy masculinities? And so, yeah, I think that you're right. That's where we kind of get the, when, you know, not just the, I mean, it's not just the fatigue. I mean, we talk in the trauma support space, we talk about vicarious trauma, this idea that you, by working with, you know, our research and our programming is often with folks who have been hurt, deeply hurt by mostly men and boys violence, other men and boys, and certainly women and girls. And I think, I think, you know, the kind of being mindful for, we can get those endorphin, you know, those endorphin hits from the connection with others who also, you know, with the kind of the contagion of the good work, But also to, you know, kind of be willing to step in on, hey, some of this is tough, right? Relationships harmed, individuals harmed, and just, you know, kind of giving ourselves that, that sort of time out to go, oof, this is tough stuff.
We do get guys that come into the spaces that are suicidal. I mean, they're having ideation at the time, or have had it, and it's okay. Yeah. So what's the process? I mean, how do we engage them in a way that, because we're just regular guys, right, Gary? I mean, we are anyways. You've studied this, but we're just regular guys. And so how can we engage them in a way that helps them? And I'm glad to say that, you know, to date, that's worked out well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the like simplest, you know, get questions from teachers for, you know, around, you know, and Chris, you work in the education space now, right? Teachers who are dealing with kids who have got, you know, witnessing violence at home, witnessing violence in their community, multiple layers of, you know, of stress and trauma that, you know, may have come down from generations, and kind of like, where do I begin? You know, and if there's any like simple thing we've learned in the trauma space is that the simple act of listening, the simple act of solidarity, is like our secret weapon. I mean, there's been experimental psychology that's done this as well. Like if you stand to people, if you ask them how difficult a task looks, whether it's climbing a hill that they can see in front of them or something that's hypothetical, if they're next to someone they trust, they always report the task looks easier. Mm-hmm. Sometimes even easier than it actually objectively is. Uh-huh. Right. So it's just like, to imagine how different you feel if somebody, you know, and you can, you know, in your own life, think about it, of after a moment when somebody says, oh, I know what you mean. You know, just that simple act is so, I mean, it doesn't replace, you know, years of therapy, et cetera, but just as like, you know, you at least know you are doing no harm. Yeah. And the problem wasn't all yours to solve, but at least the, you know, that kind of simplest of human, meaningful, authentic connection is, and you can ask a 13-year-old boy sort of how he feels afterwards, and you can go, oh, I noticed my breathing changed. And I felt that kind of thing on my skin that you sometimes feel after, like, you watched a sad movie or something. Like, even getting humans to be aware of how we're this, you know, this wired emotional, hormonal machine that reacts when we feel supported or when we feel threatened. I think even just like that tiny bit of emotional literacy, and those who can provide emotional support aware of that literacy, and those who receive it also kind of aware of that, is, you know, we can't solve it all, but it is at least like what I can do right now.
Yeah.
I feel like connection, human connection, is seriously underrated.
Yes. And seriously stressed. And stretched in ways that, you know,
I just wrote about it in my weekly email, and I've determined over the last 5 years doing this, meeting with hundreds of men, it's why I'm alive. I mean, it's why we're alive. The good and the bad of it all is, what else is there but that connection? Yeah. And I totally agree with you. It doesn't have to be complicated. It can be just so simple. Yeah. Just creating those spaces for people to get together. Yeah. So, yeah.
I'm gonna shift gears here because we do got to wrap up, and we have to ask you these three canned questions, Gary, which you're probably not aware of. Before we do that, is there any other ground that you wanted to cover? Is there anything you'd like our listeners to know, or that anyone can help with in this effort?
I mean, take a look at our website. There's a, you know, everything we produce is there. We're trying to learn, you know, use it, get in touch with us. All the stuff is open source, you know, take it apart, use what you find useful. All the studies we mentioned before are also on the website, equimundo.org. Love to, you know, connect more with schools, with parents. We're more than just me. There's 20X of us plus some fellows and consultants. So we're always happy to engage in dialogue on this.
Yeah. And we'll definitely promote your I know you've given more than one TED talk, but the most recent one was really beautiful. And we'll be certain to promote that. Okay. Here we go then. Let's Let's give him a cigarette and ask him these three questions here.
Why does he need his cigarette?
I feel like it's an execution, you know? Isn't that what you do before?
Okay. Is it true if it was after sex? Where was it?
That'll be the next cigarette.
Was it good for you? Yeah.
Right. All right, let's behave, guys. Come on. All right, here we go. What do you wish you could have told your 10-year-old self, Gary?
Oh, man. Yeah, put down that facade and you know, I probably told my mom a lot, you know, I don't care. Just the kind of the ability to engage with me and say, oh, you care deeply. And in fact, it's your superpower. Figure out how to use that rather than the, you know, put down the defensiveness.
Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Boy, if you're going to pick a superpower, I'd say caring is about as good as they come. So
yeah.
I love that. Next question is, do you have a mantra in life or a mantra these days?
Do I have a mantra? You know, yes, I suppose it is. It's the, you know, we work in fraught political times. These conversations get defensiveness by women's rights advocates who have put their life toward, you know, equality on this. And we got lots of angry men who are like, how dare you question my manhood? And I am just trying to tell myself every time before I kind of respond in, because there's a lot of heated conversations, just to sort of take a deep breath. Mm-hmm. And whatever I say coming after that, right, you've just, you know, flooded your brain with some oxygen, let it, you know, try to get your heartbeat down a little bit and then step into the conversation. I have trouble doing that in traffic, but I'm trying to do it. Trying to...
I have a hard time seeing you get pissed too. Like having,
I do
like,
too.
Pissed off at someone and having that angry conversation. Yeah.
No, it's far easier in a podcast to, yeah. You know, that's why I have to tell myself that. Just,
my yeah. I
just,
my,
just breathe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Breathe.
Pause, right? Be present. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things I've heard over the last few years came from Ted Lasso, and it was a Walt Whitman quote, be curious, not judgmental.
Yeah.
And I try to live by that, but what you just said about driving, I am never more judgmental than when I'm behind the wheel of a car.
Right.
I'm like, what is this guy doing? What are we-
Meditation helps. I used to be the same way.
Exactly. Yeah. This is my mini every couple of hours meditation. Deep breath. Deep breath. Yeah. Everything after that will be better if you just.
Yeah. Do that. I told Sean a couple episodes ago, I sort of microdose on meditation. I try to squeeze in 5-minute meditations between calls just to get recentered. Yeah. All right, let's get to the last question here and then we'll cut you loose. Little bit darker, maybe not darker, a little more serious. What do you hope people will say about you at your wake?
Oh, you know, oof, I'll try not to cry about this, but maybe what I said at my dad's, that, you know, if I put one word to who he was, he lived care. Mm-hmm. He made it a political verb. And I think I probably said those words at his funeral. So yeah, I would go with that.
So Gary, I mean, I'm getting emotional. You're carrying on your dad's work.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing.
In large part, yeah.
That's really...
Yeah. And the blessing of having somebody that their legacy, their integrity about it, you know, how thoroughly and also the long game, right? His long vision of how to do some of that. I think on good days, I think I can match some of that shadow.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
I think you're doing a stellar job. I was going to say earlier when you described your dad that your dad sounds like a saint. Maybe I sound like I'm echoing great grandmother, but
he'd push back on that, and you know, he'd laugh and ignore. And I think that's the other part I'd like to take is just, you know, and maybe the small, you know, the small text under there could be, and he could laugh at himself.
I'm wondering how big he was, though. I need to know how big.
Yeah, what position did he play?
What is he, 6'2"? And so he played tight end. He had a football neck. I don't know. I guess I didn't drink enough milk growing up. I didn't get his full height. I played tennis instead of football. Mm-hmm. It would have been nice to have, you know, to have his football throwing and catching ability as well. Mm-hmm. I would say I had some moments I wanted those things too, but I went on to run and kayak and play tennis. Those are things.
Okay. Next time we talk, Gary, I want to talk about kayaking because I lived in Idaho for a bit and still own a kayak. And right. We have to talk about Lake Atitlan in Guatemala, which I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. It's an amazing place. Yeah. Amazing place.
Oh, did you have those questions ready to go?
No, I didn't know about his connection with Guatemala. I tried to start a nonprofit down there after the Navy fell in love with the country.
All right.
But it's beautiful. I love all of Latin America, but
This has been great. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for
and
having
chatting
me.
With us.
Yeah.
And, you know, we continue to watch and support the work you're doing and the work that we do. And thank you so much for coming and chatting.
Appreciate it.
This is Chris. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of If You've Come This Far.
And this is Sean. Remember to check us out, mnliving.org.